Hour number two, it's Bickley and Marotta. We're coming to you live from the Ok Chin Community Studios here on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. College football heating up as we get closer and closer to the end of the season. Week two college football playoff rankings were released. A lot of questions about it, and here to talk about it with us, CBS college football analyst Rick Neuheisel, our guest on the Coulter Automotive Group Sports Line. Rick, how are you?
I am doing great. How are you guys today?
We're doing well. Before we dive into the college stuff, the last time we had you on the show was in anticipation of the first season for you as head coach of the Arizona Hotshots of the AAF. We all know what happened, but it seemed
I missed them.
You guys had a good team. It seemed like you were having a lot of fun in that role. How bummed were you about what happened?
Crushed. I'm telling you that we had such a blast. We had such a blast, players, coaches alike, and I really believe this in my heart of hearts. We would have won that. We would have won the thing. We were playing well. Johnny Wolford was coming into his own as our quarterback. We had a bunch of great kids on both sides of the ball that were dying to play. We knocked off the Orlando Apollos and Spurrier's team, who claimed the championship because they had the best record. I keep arguing with them. I said, "But you would have had to play us again." And you know how that went the first time. So I say we won the championship. But all in good fun. I miss it. It was a great amount of fun to be coaching again.
Yeah, but Spurrier went as far as to get rings made up for his team.
I know. I guarantee he didn't pay for it.
I guarantee that too.
I know him well enough. He didn't pay for it.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right, the college football playoff, there's a lot of speculation that has begun. There's been consternation that Alabama might find their way back in. What are some of your initial thoughts about maybe some of the pitfalls ahead or maybe some of the excitement ahead for college football?
Well, I think there are two great stories that are unfolding. The Minnesota story is a fabulous one. P.J. Fleck has done a great job there. We watched him do it at Western Michigan just a few years ago, and I call him the barista of belief. He gets those kids believing, and they start speaking the same language. It's row the boat. It's Sky Uma. It's feeling elite. It's a wonderful story. But if you watch the waning moments of that game against Penn State, where they run out on the field with the victory bell, that's what you go. There's nothing like this elsewhere in the United States. It's just great fun. The same thing's going on in Baylor, and they get a giant stage this weekend. Just a few years ago, Matt Rhule had a 1-11 team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had to get a 7-year deal before they could lure him away from Temple because they knew that it was going to be a big overhaul to try to clean up what had happened at the end of the Art Briles tenure. And so this thing goes into 1-11. Last year, they make it to postseason, playing great at the end. Now they're sitting there 9-0, and here comes Oklahoma. If they beat Oklahoma in front of a home crowd, you're going to see the same scene in Waco that you saw in Minneapolis. So both those teams, I think, still control their own destiny, despite where they sit at 13-8 in the playoff poll. But I think if you're a undefeated team at the end of the day in a Power 5 conference, you're going to be in.
Yep.
You mentioned Alabama. Alabama, you know, is in harm's way, given that they've been to the college football playoff in each of the first 5 years. But there is a way, by virtue of the fact that they were still ahead of the two Pac-12 teams that are thought so highly of in Utah and Oregon, the fact that they're still ahead of them, I think they have a chance to still impress enough to get there. Obviously, they have to win out. They're going to have to be really impressive in their win at Auburn to finish the season in the Iron Bowl. And then their hope is that Auburn plays well enough this Saturday against Georgia to knock them off. And I think actually that Auburn has a great chance to beat Georgia because Georgia's struggling offensively.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll wait and see, but lots of football still to be played.
Yeah, Rick Neuheisel, CBS Sports College Football Analyst, our guest here on the Coulter Automotive Group Sports Line. You mentioned Auburn, Rick, and I was just telling my partner before this segment started, Auburn's got its fingerprints all over this year's playoff field. You mentioned their game against Georgia is pivotal. They still have Alabama on the schedule. They're tied to Oregon, yet they're not a contender themselves, but they can really wreak havoc on this whole thing the rest of the way.
Well, I think I can make a case that given some chaos, which I think we always kind of anticipate this time of year in college football, that if they were to beat Georgia decisively and then beat Alabama decisively in the season's finale, I could make a case where you could argue them as the fourth team. Again, it takes some carnage, but but I think that they're not dead yet.
And they'd still have to get through the SEC championship.
They've been playing with a freshman quarterback all season. And, by the way, this is going to be the first time in one of these big marquee games that Bo Nix actually gets to play at home. A&M was on the road. Florida was on the road. LSU was on the road. Oregon was in a neutral site. So this is going to give him a little bit of comfort, some home cooking, if you will. And if he plays really well, it's going to be a factor. But you're right. Auburn is all over this thing.
Yeah.
And the sad thing for Oregon is they're the ones that have lost to them.
Yeah.
Everybody else is going to point to it as a huge feather in their cap, where now you start doing the comparative analysis. If you're looking at a loss, albeit a very close one, and many would say that Oregon probably should have won the game, the bottom line is it ended up in the L column.
Let me ask you this, because I love what you said about Baylor, and I feel you about Minnesota. I love that vibe, that coach, and that whole thing that they've got going. Where do you draw the line between teams that deserve to be in the playoff and the teams that we should see because we know they're the best, or we know that they would represent the college football best Final Four?
That's a great question, and really that's at the crux of it all. You know, we decided to go away from the BCS computer formula because, one, we wanted more games, and, two, we didn't like the fact that computers were deciding this when common sense told us otherwise. And we now have got 13 people who all have great integrity. We're not questioning anybody's, you know, integrity, and the recusal process is in place to keep people from talking about teams that they're familiar with or have a relationship with. But at the end of the day, we don't get enough games to really determine who's the best, given how much the styles are contrasting.
Right.
The Pac-12, if you started at the beginning of the season and went through the playoff era, Clemson had won 40 conference games over the life of the playoff. Alabama was 40-plus wins over the life of the playoff. Ohio State was 40-plus wins over the life of the playoff. And Oklahoma was the same in the Big 12 over the life of the playoffs. So there was a dominant team in each of those conferences, and all of those teams had made their way to the college football playoff. In the Pac-12, the highest win percentage was the highest win total was 33.
Wow.
33 wins, and that was, I believe, Stanford. And so if you're 7 wins behind, just because you're playing in such a much more evenly matched conference, you don't get the benefit of the doubt when you're talking to the committee. And then it becomes a perception issue, such to the fact that Washington had to go play Auburn all the way across the country in Atlanta this year, a year ago. Oregon had to go to Dallas to play Auburn to get a game where everybody says, well, that's the game. And both teams fell short in close matchups.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's like you put a nail in the casket of the Pac-12 trying to get in. This is screaming that we need to go to 8. It's screaming that every major conference needs to be represented. And the UCF story of the last couple of years is also screaming that we need to get a group of 5 team in. People always complain, oh, that's going to diminish the significance of the regular season. And I don't think anything is further from the truth. I mean, the bottom line is we're going to make more games exciting. Now, you may not be excited about seeing an ACC Coastal team as a potential in the playoff, but if they win, now we get to where you were just a second ago and called deserving. If they knock off, if Virginia ends up representing the Coastal Division of the ACC and knocks off Clemson in the ACC championship game, Virginia deserves to be in, despite the fact that they weren't great all season long. And I think that makes it more interesting. I think more fan bases are pay more attention to the regular season and to the postseason. And I think the ratings would go through the roof as we watch these matchups down the stretch.
CBS Sports college football analyst Rick Neuheisel, our guest here on Bickley and Murata. Speaking of Clemson, and they play in that ACC, which has been down this year, admittedly. They've been challenged.
They're the only team from the ACC in the top 25.
Yeah, that's true. And they had the one-point win at North Carolina, and they get into the top four this week. But they're a really hard team to gauge because of their level of dominance in a down conference. What do you make of Clemson at this point, Rick?
Well, and there's where the eye test fits in, right? We go to between deserving, and the committee can go back and forth as they see fit. But we all know what we know about Clemson. That is a dominant program. Three guys were taken in the first round of the NFL draft last year from their defensive line, and yet they're still one of the top defenses in the country. They have been running roughshod over the rest of their competition in the ACC, and as anybody that's roots for the Clemson Tigers can tell you, that's not our fault that everybody else isn't playing very good. But ultimately, they're going to be in if they continue to win out because people believe that about them. But if you put that resume, you took that uniform off and put Minnesota's uniform off in the same schedule, the same near miss against North Carolina, and put it all, they would be sitting there probably where Minnesota's sitting, at 8.
Mm-hmm. Would the SEC, would they be cool with, say, one representative in a college football playoff? Has the playoff privilege kind of skewed their perspective? And how, with a playoff committee as it stands now, and you said there's checks and balances, there's the recusal process, can the SEC still affect the situation politically?
They affected this whole process of going to four, right? It was 2011 that where LSU and Alabama played each other and the country said, we have enough. You know, the SEC had done this and now we knew we were going to get an SEC national championship champion again. And the powers that be said, we can't do this anymore. But it was the SEC that said you did not have to be a conference champion to get into the Final Four. And they're the only conference that has had two make the Final Four, is Alabama and Georgia, as you recall, played for the national title just a couple years ago when we learned the name Tua Tagovailoa. But that was all because the SEC said, we're not going to join in to this college football playoff idea unless the best four teams go, because they felt two of the best four and sometimes even three of the best four come from their particular conference. They wield a big stick. There's no question about it.
Last thing before we let you go, Rick, and we appreciate your time. What does Joe Burrow have to do to squander the Heisman Trophy at this point?
Oh, my goodness. Run afoul of the law?
Yeah.
I mean, that kid is playing so well. I was on the sideline for the game last week in Tuscaloosa.
Wow.
And saw him up close and personal. And what you don't see in a stat line, I mean, everybody can read that he was 31-39 for 393 and three touchdowns. They can see that he ran for 64 yards, which in NFL statistics would have been 90 yards, but for the sacks.
Yeah.
This kid is engineering the offense brilliantly. He's cool as a cucumber. The guy's got everything. But what you don't see in the stat line is how many times he makes people miss, and how strong he is in terms of extending plays. There were free runners at him, and I'm telling you, good-looking free runners at him at Alabama, and he found ways to make a miss, keep a play alive, keep a drive alive, and the guy is remarkable.
You got
I've said he reminds me of Tom Brady. I'm standing by it. I think he's going to have a remarkable NFL career, and he's very, very fun to watch. The trophy's his unless something just bizarre happens, meaning that a Justin Fields or a Jalen Hurts just goes absolutely crazy, and there's some tip ball interceptions that happen to poor Joe Burrow. But
you gotta,
I don't see it happening.
You got to love Ed Orgeron, don't you? The guy wasn't good enough for USC, Rick?
Absolutely. I mean, if Jambalaya could talk, that's what it would sound like.
That is so good. That's lyrical, my man. That is genius.
That is absolutely who this guy is. Now, listen, I went toe-to-toe with this guy. He was the best recruiter at USC when I was at UCLA. And I literally would have to stay in a recruit's home till midnight because I knew Ed was outside waiting to get into the recruit's house. And I knew once midnight struck, he couldn't come in because he'd already wasted his day because he was at the school. So I would walk outside and I would wave at him and say, you can't get in. This guy was such a grinder in recruiting. And I admired him from that standpoint. And listen, he went 3-21 as the head coach at Ole Miss in conference play. And he said, I wasn't ready. I was micromanaging. I was trying to do everything. And I wasn't ready to do everything, nor am I capable of doing everything. So he gets this next opportunity here at LSU. He goes and finds a guy by the name of Matt Canada to be his coordinator, and he realizes in 1 year it's not a fit, personality-wise. Doesn't work. I mean, Matt Canada has fine football plays, but the personality didn't work. He fires him. He goes and gets his buddy, Steve Ensminger, to be there, who now he knows he's got a guy he can trust. Mm-hmm. And then Ensminger tells him, after meeting this kid, Joe Brady, from the Saints, where they were trying to, you know, work towards the New Orleans Saints offense, wanting to know about RPOs, that they needed to spread things out. And this Joe Brady gets up there and is so organized and so articulate and so spot on in terms of his presentation of the RPO game from the New Orleans Saints standpoint and from what he learned at Penn State, they hire him. And this is an unbelievable, unbelievable casserole of football that's happening there.
That's great
recruiting.
That's great.
Great passion, and now great X's and O's, and it's all coming to fruition.
That's great insight.
Rick, thanks.
That's great stuff.
Thanks so much for the time and the insight. Always appreciate you coming on the show.
All right, fellas. We'll talk soon. I'll be back after the Army-Navy game.
Sounds good.
Sounds good, Rick. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Rick Neuheisel, CBS Sports college football analyst, joined us on the Coulter Automotive Group Sports Line. Coulter, your family-owned dealership for Cadillac, Buick, GMC, Nissan, and Infiniti. We switch our focus to the NBA, where last night saw another edition of the James Harden show for the Houston Rockets. Played 44 minutes. No load management for James Harden. 47 points in leading the Rockets to a 102-93 victory. We could start, there's so many things to talk about in this game.
Mm-hmm.
We could start with the James Harden effect. James Harden going up against the Clippers, who have the label of being a great defensive team. Now, they will get Paul George back. He's going to make his season debut tonight. He did not play last night. But when you have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George and Patrick Beverley, they will be a great defensive team.
Yeah.
But Harden goes off for 47 points.
Points.
Russell Westbrook, Harden's teammate, was asked after the game, what do you think of Patrick Beverley's defense on James Harden? Here's what he said.
Pat Bev trick y'all, man, like he play defense. He don't guard nobody, man. Just running around doing nothing. As you seen what happened, 47. All that commotion to your face.
Yeah, look, you know the numbers. What, 4 points came against Patrick Beverley out of those 47?
Yeah. James Harden made one shot when Patrick Beverley was defending him tonight. Here's another tweet. James Harden was 0-6 with 0-6 with 4 turnovers while guarded by Beverley. Westbrook was 6-20. So, I mean, that's just a personal dislike Russell Westbrook has for Patrick Beverley.
Oh, without a doubt. You talk about stretching a point to fit your truth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just kind of shows you the friction between them. That's classic Russell Westbrook is what it is. But that is a reminder. James Harden, when you do that against a team like that, and again, they don't have Paul George yet. So, and you know what? The Clippers, too. It's part of the load management theory when it infects a team is just sort of it diminishes the regular season in its entirety. You know what I mean? So the Clippers, I think, are going to be a team that will be playing defense a lot differently in the postseason. But this is a reminder of how good James Harden is and how the Rockets are always going to keep winning games regardless because of that guy. That's kind of what it told me.
James Harden, this was from ESPN Stats and Info. James Harden had 47.7 assists against the Clippers. Harden is the third player in NBA history with at least 70 career 40.5 assist games. The only two other guys to do it, Michael Jordan and Oscar Robertson.
Wow. That's good company.
Jordan did it 96 times. The Big O did it 75. Harden got his 70th last night.
Wow.
And he shows, I mean, he's not slowing down.
Cow.
If anything, James Harden's offensive game is just getting stronger and stronger. Mm-hmm. The other thing to talk about for this game, a lot of jawing back and forth. Doc Rivers, the head coach of the Clippers, disagreed with a call. He got ejected finally. And Austin Rivers, his son, who plays for the Rockets, who was once traded by his father.
This is great.
is urging the referees to tee up his dad. Here was Austin Rivers after the game.
I knew it was coming. I can see him. I've seen that look before many times. Once he starts blinking his eyes fast, he starts. That's when I know he's about to level up. So I just started telling Tony to get him. And they got him.
It was classic. Watching the video of it was really funny to me because you're like, that's dude's dad.
Yeah.
That's his dad. He's like, come on, give him a tee. Give him a tee. And Doc's going nuts. Oh, man.
Then Austin Rivers was, you know, he had tweeted out after the game, Thanksgiving's going to be awkward. And a reporter pointed out to Austin Rivers, hey, you guys play again before Thanksgiving.
I doubt we'll go to dinner or anything like that. He actually is sensitive to stuff like that, so we'll see what happens. But I love him. I mean, it was a really good moment, though. I enjoyed it a lot. I'm not going to lie to you. I really did enjoy that. It's fun.
They do play again next Friday.
Wow.
They both exchanged comments on social media as well. But that is such a weird dynamic. I've never seen anything like that before. It was kind of funny.
No, it was. It was hysterical. There was a lot of cool stuff, interesting stuff that came out of that game.
Yeah, here was Doc Rivers when he was, hey, did you see your son trying to get you teed up?
I don't know if you noticed, but Austin was behind you kind of telling the refs to tee you.
Yeah, well, he should. You know, he should. I didn't care. I saw him, actually. But
yeah, that's good. That's really good.
It was funny. Coming up, a Yahoo Sports writer has ranked every first-round quarterback draft pick in the last 10 years. Curious to see where Kyler Murray ended on that list?
Yeah,
we'll get into it next. Bickley and Murata, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. Last week on Theme Thursday, this is about the time I felt pretty good about things.
Okay.
A, I haven't been paying as much attention to but I got no clue.
No, yeah, listen, I want this to be listener engagement. So when our listeners get the clue, they should start tweeting out what it is.
So it's, yes, all these rejoiner music all have something in common.
They all are karaoke versions of popular songs.
They are. They're instrumentals.
That's not the theme.
No, that's
though,
not
right?
the theme. They could, so the, yeah, it could be the singer, it could be the song title, it could be anything.
Yeah, I got nothing yet.
I like it. All right, listeners, see what you got.
Yeah.
There you go.
I like to challenge the listeners. Kevin Kaduk of Yahoo Sports, I believe that's how you pronounce his name. He used to be a baseball writer, now he's writing football for YahooSports.com. He did a study on, well, not a study, but a ranking, his own ranking of every first-round draft pick used on a quarterback in the last 10 drafts. Overall, in that time span, there's been 117 quarterbacks drafted. In the first round, there's been 30 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he ranked them 1 to 30.
Right.
And I found this list to be fascinating.
Okay.
You want to start at the top or the bottom?
Well, however you want to do it.
Let's start at the top. I'll give you a few guesses.
I don't want to guess. Okay. I want you just to roll through it.
Well, you don't want to be challenged, I guess.
No, no, I don't like guessing games on the radio.
Patrick Mahomes was ranked as the number one quarterback in that time spot.
Is that right?
In that time span. 10th pick in 2017.
Okay.
The rest of the top five, he had Cam Newton at number two. A lot of this is based on not exactly where these active quarterbacks are now,
all right,
but what they've accomplished in their careers.
Okay.
Andrew Luck, number three. Deshaun Watson, four. Lamar Jackson, five.
Five.
Already. the rest of the top 10, Carson Wentz, six. Above Jared Goff, they're in the same draft in 2016. Goff's been to a Super Bowl. Wentz has not. Number seven, Jared Goff. Number eight.
Wentz has not been there on a technicality because he was injured, but he did.
Yeah. He triggered that great season.
You can't guarantee the Eagles make it to
fair.
The Super Bowl without Nick Foles.
Right. That's true.
This is where the list got a little wonky for me.
Okay.
Number eight, Ryan Tannehill.
What?
He writes, Tannehill is the true divider of this list. Nearly everyone that came before him is either unproven or a relative bust. Everyone that comes after can be listed as a successful pick because he was going in descending order.
All right.
With a career 45-47 record, Tannehill is as close to average as you can get. It's worth wondering, though, how he would have done had he been drafted by a more functional organization. I don't think there's any way to quantify Ryan Tannehill as the eighth best quarterback drafted in the first round in that span.
That seems kind of silly.
Number nine, and maybe this is just a lack of quality overall, Teddy Bridgewater.
Uh-huh.
Good story. Was decent in Minnesota as a starter. Decent this year as a spot starter for Drew Brees, mm-hmm. but certainly not a complete career. Number 10, Baker Mayfield.
Yeah, a little premature for that.
And number 11, Kyler Murray.
There you go.
Of the Arizona Cardinals. He writes, the Cardinals ignored all the maxims about a short quarterback not succeeding in the NFL, and it's worked out so far even with a poor offensive line in front of him. Murray might have the most room of anyone to move up on this list.
Okay.
A couple of other notables. Josh Allen at 12. This is going to make people break out in hives when I say this name. Sam Bradford at 13. Dwayne Haskins at 14. How?
Well, how is Sam Bradford at 13? His career record's 34-48-1.
Well, I mean, but still, Sam Bradford at least has accomplished something in this league. Dwayne Haskins is a new starter, I get it, and their offense is atrocious. But how could he be 14th? How could he be above Sam Darnold and Daniel Jones, which he is? He's got Jameis Winston at 18,
mm-hmm.
below Marcus Mariota. To me, that doesn't make sense because Winston hasn't lost his job yet.
No.
Brandon Weeden at number 19. So he's telling us there's 11 quarterbacks worse than Brandon Weeden that were drafted in the first round in that 10-year time span.
That's crazy. 20. Tim Tebow, who won a playoff game, man.
He did. Blaine Gabbert, 21. This is just depressing. EJ Manuel, 22. Blake Bortles, 23. Robert Griffin III, 24. Christian Ponder, 25. 26, Jake Locker. Mitchell Trubisky, 27.
Oh.
I know he is not revered by Chicago Bears fans.
Yeah.
Mitchell Trubisky has done more in his time as a Bears quarterback than Jake Locker did or Christian Ponder did. EJ Manuel?
Stupid list.
After the first seven, I think this list is
pretty dumb. Yeah, pretty dumb.
Josh Rosen, 28.
Yeah.
Johnny Manziel, 29. Not last. 30, Paxton Lynch.
Wow.
The biggest takeaway I had from this list, though, Bick, be careful about drafting a quarterback in the first round.
Isn't that the truth?
Wow.
Ryan Tannehill at 8, that's kind of mind-blowing to me. I do agree with this whole thing about Kyler Murray having the ability to move up from 11 because I think when we get some distance from the season, I think we'll realize that what Kyler Murray's done here has been pretty terrific, and that interceptionless streak was no joke. It ended at the terrible time last week, but to go that far as a rookie without making mistakes, to produce the way he has, to kind of burn at the right temperature the way he has, that's going to turn out to be a really good pick considering what could have been had they decided to go with the Nick Bosa, Josh Rosen thing. My opinion.
Only a few months in, and it's the difference between, 17 spots on that list?
Yeah, 17 spots. But it's just a list.
I agree with the assertion, too, that he's got more room to move up than anybody mm-hmm. else. On Kyler Murray, though, and again, it's been impressive. It hasn't necessarily equated to wins on a consistent basis.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been really good as a rookie. But he hasn't had that wow game. We've been talking about this for a few weeks now. How disappointed will you be if we don't have that wow game from Kyler Murray before the end of the year?
Yeah, I think I don't know. That's a good question. It really is, because I think he's had a lot of wow moments.
Yes.
The wow game, man, he was so close last week before he threw that interception. Maybe a little bit that they don't put it all together because we're hearing that they're really close to doing it. You've had a couple of 3-touchdown games from young players, Chase Edmonds and Christian Kirk, both have them. Andy Isabella is beginning to make plays. Contrary to what this guy in this article says, the Cardinals' offensive line isn't poor. They're not great. I don't even know if you'd call them good, but they're not poor.
It's funny how that's
middle
still,
of the pack. Yeah,
it's still kind of there, that label. Yeah, right. And it's not accurate. So I don't know if I'd be disappointed if he doesn't have a blowout game, but yeah, I would be disappointed if he doesn't have his best game to date before the end of the season, if that makes sense. I guess we're just splitting hairs now. But because I do think that he does keep improving, and I think that he does...
It is funny that statistically, with yards and stuff, his first two games were like his two best games. Wasn't he like the first quarterback, like rookie quarterback ever to...
Plus, it was 300, above 300 yards in the first two games. To that point, yeah. I had to look it up. What game would you say was his best game?
I really like last week's game until the interception, and that's a big caveat to it.
It's a big if.
It's a real, real big if. But, I mean, they was throwing down the field.
A big until.
I don't know.
I mean, his best quarterback rating of the year was the San Francisco game.
That game felt okay. It didn't feel like his best to me.
Yeah, 17 to 24, 241 yards, two touchdowns, ran for 34 yards on five carries.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta was good. 27 of 37, 340, three touchdowns, 32 yards rushing.
Yeah.
The week before against Cincinnati, he threw for 250 and ran for almost 100, but didn't have a touchdown pass. He did have a touchdown run.
That Detroit game was so horrible to start.
Yeah.
But then the second half was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. I think this just kind of proves our point. He hasn't had that game yet. If I got to go back and look at the statistics, and there's not one that jumps off the top of my
head. I know what you're saying.
They've all been good.
Yeah, he was really good at Baltimore under the circumstances. Everyone kind of has its own little framework, if you know what I mean. You're right. There's just not that one bam game.
Yeah.
415 yards, four touchdowns, and a Cardinal victory.
Yeah.
Something like
ran
that.
For 75.
Ran for 75. Yeah. Something like that.
We'll just shorten it. We'll call it a Lamar Jackson type game.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I mean, it's... Yeah, last week he was terrific, but that big interception and that interception was everything, so that automatically disqualifies. Yeah. His passer rating against the 49ers was terrific, but
he hasn't had that real stinker game yet either.
No.
I guess Carolina is the closest thing to that.
And I think that's kind of the differentiation here.
Yeah, yeah. Steady as a rookie, pretty good.
Right.
Listen each day this week at 7:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., 4:30 p.m. For your name and the chance to spin the wheel of sports trips. Every qualifier wins an Amazon Echo, plus a shot at trips to Cards at Seahawks, Suns at Lakers, ASU hoops at the Pac-12 tournament, D-backs at Cubs next April. Text the word spin. You can still get involved. Text that to 620-620. Right? Again, spin to 620-620. It's the Arizona Sports Wheel of Sports Trips. Coming up, they say if you're not cheating, you're not trying. Well, apparently no one tries harder than the Houston Astros. We'll get into that next. Bickley and Murata, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
Well, it's a big deal for a few reasons, Al. You start off with the fact that the Astros won the World Series in 2017, and these sorts of allegations have been percolating around baseball since then. You know, the Oakland A's in 2018, the team that Mike Fiers was playing for, alleged during the regular season that there was a clapping coming out of the Astros dugout. In 2019, the American League Championship Series this year, the New York Yankees said there was whistling coming from the Astros dugout. And even in the World Series this year, Washington Nationals players were warned to look for clapping, to look for whistling, to even look up in left field on the train tracks because they were worried people were going to be spying on them up there. Now, up until this point, it's been a lot of allegations, but Mike Fiers going on the record about this for the first time really has given some meat to this.
That's Jeff Passan of ESPN, their baseball insider, talking about the massive allegations that have been heaped on the Houston Astros for sign stealing. You've probably seen the article by now. Mike Fiers, the former Astros pitcher who did not pitch in the World Series in 2017, was ineffective down the stretch, but has moved on to a couple teams since. And he's the one guy that has come forward by name and told what was going on. The article appeared in The Athletic. There's been several video breakdowns of instances where this has happened that are it looks so clear cut the way it's presented. Yeah, this is a big deal. And there's the group of people, Bick, that will look at this and go, oh, sign stealing is as old as the sport of baseball. Yeah, but there's kind of an etiquette to it.
Yeah, there is.
You know, if you got a guy, and we talked so much in the postseason in real time about the Astros and their ability to identify pitches that were coming. You know, he was tipping his pitches. There's an art to that. And I don't think that is infringing on the etiquette of sign stealing.
Mm-hmm.
You got a runner on second base. Yeah, you're going to have to try to guard your signs because they're going to try to steal them. But installing a camera in center field that's hooked up to a monitor that's out of sight in between the dugout and the clubhouse in Houston side and the constant trash can banging or whistling and clapping to indicate what pitch is coming, that's just downright awful.
It's a bad look. And in some of the videos, you can see why it's just so bad for baseball. When you isolate some individual at-bats and you hear the banging going off and you see guys taking healthy cuts at change-ups, and then you see a pitcher kind of go, wait a minute, and you see him putting it all together.
Well, that video,
Farquhar guy.
Danny Farquhar was pitching for the White Sox, and he's out of baseball now. He's a coach. But he also talked about it. That video was the most telling to me.
Yeah.
Because the third time he hears the banging, and he immediately steps off and calls
his catcher out.
Covers the mouth with the, hey, we got to switch things up. They're on to us here.
And then he strikes out the guy in an off-speed pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's taking cheating to a different level. And now Major League Baseball has got an issue because there's two other managers involved who are disciples of the Astros and A.J. Hinch. It's Alex Cora in Boston, Carlos Beltran in New York.
Who was just named as the Mets manager, by the way.
Right. And now you got three guys who might be, you know, involved in this. The Yankees are livid because the Yankees filed a complaint with Major League Baseball, and Major League Baseball did nothing about it. Basically said, there's nothing to see here. And the Yankees now, you know, this team is in their way. And to call the Astros the new Yankees is kind of ironic because they are kind of the evil empire now. And now the old evil empire is going, what is going on here? I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And I don't like the way A.J. Hinch has kind of handled himself in all of this. When the Yankees made that complaint about whistling, A.J. Hinch completely marginalized and belittled the Yankees for that.
I got a kick out of it.
I got a kick out of it. They're so paranoid, they're making me laugh. Yeah, I am not an A.J. Hinch fan whatsoever, and now more than ever. This is just really, I hear this phrase all the time. Play the game the right way. In baseball, it's ridiculous. But on some level, it's true, and this isn't playing the game the right way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Beltran was part of the 2017 World Series Championship Club with the Astros. Cora was the bench coach with A.J. Hinch that time around. He's since won a World Series as the manager of the Boston Red Sox, so you have to wonder. He's involved in the investigation now. Part of the thing that I was thinking about yesterday, too, Bick, was Mike Fiers, who's still an active major league pitcher, okay?
Yeah.
Is he a hero or is he a snitch?
Well, yeah.
Depending on how this shakes out, obviously.
No. But you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, "Oh, what are you doing? You're going to give that World Series ring back?"
You don't think the members, his teammates from that 2017 Houston team, think he's a snitch?
Of course they do. Of course they do, because they're going to say, "Look, you benefited from this, dude." You know, but that to me,
unless he was indignant in real time,
how would you do that?
I don't approve of this, guys.
No, well, listen, you bring up a good point, okay? Because there are hitters on the Houston Astros who are really good who don't need that kind of help. And now they're part of this, like it or not.
Well, there's a lot of hitters in Major League Baseball, too, that they don't want to know what's coming. So that might explain why there wasn't the banging on every pitch or there wasn't the constant use of this system that had apparently been devised by the Astros. And if I was a hitter, I'd probably want to know what was coming if I could.
Look, if you're on a baseball team and they say to you, this is what we do and this is what we provide, I doubt you would really have to be somebody very different to go, no, that's cheating. I'm not going to be part of that. Because at the same time, you got to fit in with the group.
Yeah, you do. And that's why Mike Fiers didn't say anything until two years later.
That's right. Because then it looks like you're judging your peers. And that's a good way to get yourself ostracized.
And honestly, I don't know if he came forward and offered this information to the writer unsolicited or if he was contacted about it. That I'm not sure is how that process went down, because I think that could be the difference between the snitch label and not.
Well, the Astros really have not, they've not dignified themselves, put it this way. From their assistant GM to the way, they're disgusting. I'm sorry, Cliff Kingsbury, I know they're your favorite team. Do not like this group one bit.
Jarrett put this out on Twitter, Major League Baseball fans, which is worse, cameras to steal signs, using PEDs, or neither bothers me? What do you think? Cameras actually won. Is winning the vote, 86 votes right now, 42%, 33% using PEDs, 26% say neither bothers me. I respect the tradition in the stealing of the signs. I get it. Like I said, I believe there's an etiquette to it, and this is, you know, trampling all over that etiquette.
There's got to be some element of fair play to competition. It doesn't have to be Pollyanna. It doesn't have to be, you know, all prim and proper, but there's just a level you don't go to.
Yep.
And using high-def electronics and computer technology to film in real time, decode what the sign is, and bang something in the dugout, no. Man.
At least they switched it up from trash can banging to whistling to clapping.
Can't they just put a mouthpiece on somebody in the dugout and an earpiece in the pitcher and call a game that way?
Well, I mean, the technology would exist now where it could be an electronic exchange between catcher and pitcher, like a sensor in the glove, something like that.
Yeah, right. Do something like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The idea of putting down signs, it's just rid of that.
We know baseball only uses technological advances to slow down the game.
That's right.
So I don't know if they'd be interested in that. We're halfway through on this Thursday. The Bickley Blast is straight ahead. It's Bickley and Murata live from the Ak Chin Community Studios, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.